Hey, it's Christine from Storyworthy. Were you brought up a religious person? Did it make you feel guilty?
My big problem is I'm anxious, but I'm worried, well, I'm terrified about going to hell.
Did anyone ever tell you that they have all the answers?
Jesus says all you have to do is accept him into your heart and then you're saved. That's it. Let's do it right now. You don't want to go to hell. You don't have to go to hell. Just say, Jesus, I believe you died on the cross for my sins. Jesus, I believe you died on the cross for my sins. Just say it. Say it now. I'll do it with you.
Well, did you try it?
I bristle. It's not like I don't know the drill. I've probably converted more people than he has, I think, with a surprising burst of righteous indignity, remembering my success with creepy single men and oxygen-assisted elderly ladies at shopping malls.
Today on Storyworthy, author Maggie Rowe shares her story, My First Day at an Evangelical Psychiatric Institute. It's a good one. Stay close.
Hey, it's Maggie Rowe, and you are listening to Storyworthy.
Blackburn, and I'm coming to you from Los Angeles, California. Now, I am so glad you guys tuned in today. Whether you're a longtime fan of the show or a new listener, welcome to Storyworthy. Now, I hope you enjoyed the story last week from author Madison Perry, Too Old for Backpacking. Too Old for Backpacking. This was a great story. And as a former backpacker, like just the title, I totally get it, you know, because now I'm ancient. But when I was in my 20s and even 30s, I mean, I backpacked all the time. After a while, you just, you know, you get tired of traveling with like your bed on your back. You know what I mean? Like with your sleep sack, as it were. Call me Miss Fancy Pants, but now I like having my own toilet, you know, not the shared bathroom. So I want you guys to go back and definitely listen to Madison Perry's story about being too old for backpacking. You're going to love that. But today you guys have tuned in for a really great episode with author Maggie Rowe. Now she brings forth the topic, My First Day at an Evangelical Psychiatric Institute. And I say, Maggie, I've had this story like 7 times. Come on now. Now, this is specific, right, you guys? And it is from her book, Sin Bravely, A Memoir of Spiritual Disobedience. And that book actually just came out this spring. And I have to say, it's such a good book. It's sad. Some of it is unbelievable that kids grow up like this. But then it's also very powerful. So, you know, it's about Maggie's incredible story growing up in a Southern Baptist family outside of Chicago. Now, her parents were actually like pretty moderate. But the church she was in and the religion she was a part of was much more like, at least to me, it was like cult-like. And Maggie was in deep. And then as you're reading the book, the ending comes along and you do not see it coming. And I'm definitely not going to ruin that surprise, but it is just fantastic. And you know, I think I've told you guys before, I grew up Catholic. And I mean, she was Baptist. It's totally different, but Catholic. I mean, just any type of you know, organized religion like that. It's tough for a kid. I hated it. I hated every minute of it. The standing, the sitting, the kneeling, the call and response. Every week was the same. You never got new information. But I remember very specifically when it occurred to me how horrible this whole Catholic religion thing was. And it was the hypocrisy that got to me. I was about 13 years old. And Father Charnocki, who was like the big heavy-set priest with like a big white pasty face. He was doing the sermon, which is the part where they get to like speak freely, right? And he started telling everybody in the congregation to write to ABC because they had this show on called Soap, and Billy Crystal was playing a homosexual and how that was a sin, of course. And I remember looking down the pew at my dad and thinking, that's your favorite show. I mean, we love Soap. We love All in the Family. I mean, we love these shows. How could this be? And that was my first like questioning the whole situation. But anyway, my father, boy, it's funny. He was such a contradiction that way. He was the one that, you know, said, you know, God gives you 24 hours a day, every day of the week, and you can't give him 1 hour on Sunday. He wasn't including the hour of CCD that we also had to do, you know, the catechism. But Anyway, and on the other hand, my dad loved Monty Python, and he loved Peter Sellers and any comedy, and that's where I got all my comedy chops. If I have any at all, it's from my dad. So I think my dad, he saw the hypocrisy, but I don't know. I guess you just, a lot of people just follow what their parents do, and that's safe, and that's secure to them, and they just follow. Or maybe they really believe. What do I know? All right, you guys, before we get to Maggie's story, I did want to remind you guys to follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Storyworthy. You see how easy I make that? I just say at Storyworthy. Like, you can't spell it wrong. You can't go to the wrong place. You're going to go to the right place, at Storyworthy, right? And then, of course, head over to storyworthypodcast.com, a little bit different, but still very clear, storyworthypodcast.com, and check out my website. And, you know, I've got some sponsors over there, and when you guys support my sponsors, then in fact, you are supporting me, because what those sponsors do is they send me money. And that, at the end of the day, feeds my child. And as you know, she likes to eat every day, which, surprising, I didn't know that becoming a parent. But in fact, yes, every day I feed her. One more thing, you guys, head over to Apple Podcasts and give Storyworthy a 5-star review. You know I need that, right? So you do the 5 stars and then you actually leave a review on top of that. Those are my wishes. That's what you can do for me, yeah? Thank you. Okay, you guys, she's here right now, Maggie Rowe. She is a writer, and her new book, Sin Bravely, a memoir of spiritual disobedience, like I said, is just so unique and so interesting, and then has a little twist at the end that is just, actually, the twist at the end is modifies the title, Sin Bravely. What she does at the end, she sins, and she does it bravely. Maggie also has a long-running show here in Los Angeles called Sit and Spin. I've been on that show. It's a lot of fun. And she also has sold pilots to Disney, Nickelodeon, HBO. She's written on Arrested Development and Flaked, both for Netflix. And she's also the creator of a couple of really interesting live shows that I definitely want to talk to her about. One is called Hollywood Hell House, and one is called Hollywood Purity Ball. And I believe, or I know, both of these are surrounding her funky religious upbringing and everything she's been through. So we'll talk about that as well. You can find Maggie over on Twitter at Sit and Spin LA, and also at her website, MaggieRowAuthor.com. All right, you guys, wherever you are, put your hands together for Maggie Rowe.
Hello, Christine. Hi, Maggie. I love that your moment of doubt came over the homosexual character in soap. That's amazing. It's like, oh, well, this can't be right. That's a great show. All right, enough with this Catholicism. I love that that's what began the break for you. So the segment that I'm going to read, this is about my first day at an evangelical psychiatric facility called Grace Point. And I went there for one incredibly specific reason. I was scared of going to hell. And I felt that if I went to any sort of secular hospital or a counseling program, they would just say, hell isn't real. It's a scare tactic from the Middle Ages. Grow up, move on. So I felt this was where I had to be. I had a therapist with a bit of compromised intelligence who became my personal counselor and my nemesis in many ways. But the passage I'm going to read is from my very first day there. Bethany, my therapist, introduces me to my fellow patients, whom she calls the gang, and smiles proudly, evidently pleased with her lack of formality. Dwayne is an unsettlingly still man who appears to be one of those wooden Indians come to life, barely. Next, there's Ron and John, a pair of freckled, red-haired twins, probably in their late teens, who both look as if someone has just beeped a horn at them and they're in the process of recovering from the fright. Bethany points to the two boys and, like an upbeat hostess providing conversation fodder, says, Ron and John also suffer from obsessive thoughts, in the way someone might say, Ron and John also enjoy trying new foods and dipping candles. Petra is a hairdresser with tanning bed, rust-colored skin, and talon-like nails, put together but clearly falling apart. Mickey is a 60-ish petite Captain Kangaroo lookalike. It's nice to meet you, Maggie, he says, offering a broad smile that reveals a bright slab of teeth far too large for an ordinary human mouth. The joy of the Lord is my strength, his t-shirt reads, and I wonder how, if that's true, he has found himself here. Then there's Timbo, a biker-type dude with a red beard who I can easily picture cheering with vigor at an illegal dogfight. And completing the circle is Quinn, a warm, doughy woman in her mid-30s with perfect Cupid's bow lips and deep blue eyes. Her smile is relaxed, I notice, as if she's just saying hello instead of trying to make an impression. I like Quinn immediately. Bethany explains that every morning the gang checks in and tells everyone how they're feeling. If you have trouble, you can always look up here, she says, indicating a poster on the wall listing about 100 feelings. Timbo, will you start us off? How are you feeling today? Timbo, who is alternating between cracking his knuckles and tugging on his ears in an obvious state of agitation, mutters, "Fine, I'm fine." Bethany smiles. Oh, fine is not an emotion. Timbo blows air through his nostrils like a bull, his face flushing. Well, what is it then? Well, I don't know what the right feeling word might be for you this morning, Timbo, but fine is not on the list. Well, who made up the list? Timbo fumes. You? What are you, the expert on the world? I'm not any kind of expert on the world, Timbo. I think you know that, Bethany says affably. Only God can claim that title. I don't know what you're feeling, but would a word like this help? Bethany points to the word anger on the board, and Timbo explodes. Well, okay, now I am angry because you're telling me it's not okay for me to be fine. Like I have to be on some roller coaster all the time. Like I'm some woman. Fine, you win. I'm angry. I'm really angry. Okay, Timbo's feeling angry, Bethany summarizes in a studied calm, which I'm guessing proves to herself that she's a true professional. Next, she turns to Dwayne, the lifelike wooden Indian. Dwayne, how are you feeling today? Dwayne takes a pause long enough for me to wonder if he's still breathing before sighing and attempting an answer. I guess bored. Bethany replies, well, bored is also not an emotion. Timbo from across the circle barks. It's on the board, he points. Bored is on the board. It's after bitter and before brave. It's right there. Bethany turns and sees that bored is indeed on the list and must reluctantly concede. Well, okay then, Dwayne is feeling bored. And Timbo, I'd like you to think some more about the word angry. Next, she addresses the twins, who both wear rubber bands on their left wrists, which for some reason they are snapping repeatedly. Hey guys, looks like you've got some stuff happening. She speaks to the twin closest to her. Ron, how are you feeling? Ron wheezes out, scared. Bethany repeats, scared. Ron is feeling scared. Then she turns to Ron's even less bold twin and asks, and you, John? John manages to sputter, same. Bethany responds, same as? John's face turns red. Same as my brother, huh? Scared. Oh, you two have a lot in common. Bethany appears to be attempting a joke. Has anyone ever told you that you look alike? Ron and John don't know what to make of this. They look at each other for help before Ron lamely replies, yes, we're twins. Bethany at least knows to move on when a joke has fallen flat, so she turns to Petra. Petra's troubled eyes turn into two puddles and she chokes out one word, lonely. Bethany oddly upbeat coos, oh, that's a good one, lonely, then winks with both eyes. I've got to add that one to the list. Bethany shifts her focus to Mickey, our resident Captain Kangaroo. Mickey, how are you feeling this morning? This is the day that the Lord has made, he says, showing his great wall of teeth. Let us rejoice and be glad in it. Yes, let's. But Mickey, can you tell us how do you feel right now? Mickey looks around the room as if in wonder at this thing called life. Amazed, humbled, gobsmacked. Then looking up towards the ceiling, he continues, Lord, your wonders truly are unceasing. Your mercies astounding. My cup runneth over. Mickey shakes his head in theatrical astonishment at his good fortune and slaps his knee as if to say, hot damn. Oh, yes, Mickey, okay. But right this moment, what does it feel like to be Mickey?
It feels like being a child of God.
And what does being a child of God feel like?
It feels terrific.
So right now you're feeling terrific?
You betcha.
All right, Mickey feels terrific. Bethany turns to Quinn. Quinn, I guess I feel like I'm missing out. missing out? Well, you know that feeling when you look in a picture window and you see kids playing, maybe a little girl trying out her tap shoes or playing the piano, and I don't know, brothers tackling each other, and it just seems like that's where life is, inside that window, and you're on the outside? Is that feeling called envy, do you think? Are you feeling envious? Well, no, more like I'm missing out. Not that I specifically want what someone else has, but that there are joys in life that I don't have access to. Jealous? Well, no, I think jealousy is like being protective over something you already have, and I more have this feeling of missing out. Deprived? Bethany asks with heightened diction as if to impress an unseen supervisor. Well, no, deprived implies that someone has wronged me in some way. Well, what word would you like to go with? Can I just go with missing out? Can that be my word? Bethany screws her face up and asks quizzically, as if to point out what she clearly feels is the absurdity of Quinn's response. You feel missing out? Well, I feel like I'm missing out. Okay, Quinn, what we're trying to do in Morning Check-In is to clue in what you're feeling in this moment. So right now, how are you feeling? Well, I was trying to explain how I feel. Jealous? Bethany completes her sentence as if the suggestion hadn't just been rejected. Quinn starts to throw her hands up in frustration, but then her right hand bats her left back down into her lap in a very literal show of self-restraint, and she replies evenly, okay, sure, jealous. Oh, excellent! Quinn is feeling jealous. Bethany, pleased with the deftness of her psychological probing, now turns to me. And Maggie, how are you feeling? If you need help, you can look at the board. I'll go with anxious, I say. I'm anxious about being here, but also, I mean, overall, well, my big problem is I'm anxious, that I'm worried, well, I'm terrified about going to hell. And before I can complete my sentence, Mickey bleats out rapid fire. Jesus says all you have to do is accept him into your heart and then you're saved. That's it. Let's do it right now. You don't want to go to hell. You don't have to go to hell. Do it now. I clearly disappoint Mickey with my reply. Oh, I've accepted Jesus into my heart already, probably like 10,000 times. It's just like, I feel like I can never be 100% sure that I got it right. Mickey clutches his fingers around the seat of his chair, apparently to restrain himself from pouncing on me and getting some sort of commission on my salvation. Just say, Jesus, I believe you died on the cross for my sins. Jesus, I believe you died on the cross for my sins. Just say it. Say it now. I'll do it with you. I bristle. It's not like I don't know the drill. I've probably converted more people than he has, I think, with a surprising burst of righteous indignity, remembering my success with creepy single men and oxygen-assisted elderly ladies at shopping malls. Mickey, Bethany interrupts, there's no cross-talking in Morning Check-In. Maggie said her feeling. She is feeling anxious. Maggie is anxious. Anxious. Maggie is anxious. Hearing my name repeated along with the word anxious has the unfortunate effect of making me even more anxious.
Well, of course it would make you more anxious. It makes me anxious just hearing that they were drilling you like that. Okay, Maggie, back up and tell us why you found yourself in the psychiatric institute. And did you admit yourself? How does that work?
Yes, good question. So I did admit myself. Basically what happened is I grew up with this terrifying fear of hell. And when I was in high school, I started to suppress those fears. And then in college, and I started backsliding, which is the word Christians often use for falling away from the faith. I started having sex with my boyfriend in college, which was definitely a significant sin. And then, in a very odd turning point in my life, I went to see this film, Akira Kurosawa's film Dreams. And it's a Japanese art house flick with dreamlike imagery, mainly having to do with guilt, retribution, sin, and fear of punishment.
Who took you to this film?
I went with my college boyfriend.
So it was like a very mature thing to do. It
yes.
was on campus, I'm
yes,
sure.
Yes, it was on campus yeah. at the student union. Oh, and it was yeah. the it was Saturday
Smart.
Night.
Yeah.
It was the artsy film to go see. And, you know, we had seen Rashomon, Kurosawa's other film, and we were fancying ourselves intellectuals.
Sure.
This is something we did every Saturday
but
night.
But that's age appropriate. I mean, that makes sense.
Yeah.
It's great.
Yeah, I'm, you know, learning, I'm educating sure. myself. And as I'm in this theater and all of this imagery is coming at me, the all of the fear of hell that I had repressed through all the years, that I had stuffed down, started to come to the surface, and I started sweating, and I looked around at all the people in the theater, and they started to look like corpses. My heart started beating, and I couldn't breathe, and I couldn't figure out whether I needed to inhale or I needed to exhale.
It's a panic attack.
It was a panic attack. I looked over at my boyfriend, and his teeth looked serrated, like shark's teeth for me. Everything just became very surreal. I squeezed his hand, and they just felt like bones. I got this really like metallic taste in my mouth.
You did not take any drugs.
And I did not take any drugs.
There Seriously, were no... this is just the impact of one film.
Yes.
Dreams by Kurosawa.
Yes.
I'm totally going to see this movie now, I have to tell
it,
you.
It, you know, I've looked at it since then, and I totally see why it...
Wasn't so impactful.
Yeah. I mean, the first image is a little boy who disobeys his mother by going to see a wedding of two foxes in the forest, you know. And he goes back and tells his mom that he disobeyed, and she gives him a sword to plunge into his stomach because he can never be forgiven for that. So it's the pretty big imagery, like your mom
right.
is telling. So I'm in the theater, and then I hear this like yelping sound, and I realize that it's coming from my mouth. It's me making the sound. And so I crawl over everybody in the theater, like panting, knocking people's knees, and trying to breathe. And I, you know, go out into the, you know, January wind outside the student union. My boyfriend follows me, and he's like, "What's up?" And I was like, "I can't ever have sex with you again. We can't be together. I can't do any of the things that I've been doing. I need to repent. I've made a terrible mistake. I have risked the eternal state of my soul. And my life was never the same." It really, like, talk about the power of film. Like, and later, it's interesting, I read an essay by Kurosawa, and he was talking about that his goal for this film was the evocation of fears of the afterlife. So,
wow.
Certainly mission accomplished for me.
So you're 18 years old.
Yeah.
And so this makes you think that I am crazy.
I'm crazy, and I'm terrified of going to hell, and I need to figure out... So after that, I was just a wreck. I was trying to figure out how to get my salvation back, or if I had ever lost it, or, and you know, there's a verse that in the Bible that's, if you are neither hot nor cold, but are lukewarm for Christ, God will spit you out of his mouth
yeah,
on judgment
not good
day.
Enough. Not
yeah.
good enough.
So I was like, I don't know. I don't know. So I called my parents, and they found me this place. Called...
Are you an only child, by the way?
No, I have a younger sister.
A younger sister. Did she go through some of this stuff?
No.
Because your parents weren't really the one who put all this on
No.
you. You did it to yourself, sort of.
I did. It was a combination of having OCD tendencies to begin with, being a smart kid, being a thoughtful kid, and it was just fertile ground for all of those obsessive tendencies to bloom. My sister didn't have those.
So your parents are going to church each week, your sister's going to church, but you're the one who takes off with it, and you find this sense of community that is so impactful to you and so innate that that's so funny. You saw that film, and most people might just say, fuck it, fuck religion, and instead you said, I need more help.
I got to go back.
That's what puts you in this psychiatric place.
That's what was the single, you read books. And
yeah.
Like people's life change in an instant and you're like, really? Does that really happen? My life changed in an instant.
And how long did you spend in that psychiatric institute?
3 months.
3 months is a long period of time.
It was a long period of time. And I had... some terrible therapists, and I had one really wonderful therapist.
Because the story you just told, it sounds like one flew over the cuckoo's nest.
Yes. So Bethany was my nurse Ratchet.
Right.
And she was the one, when I told her that I would get so upset about my eternal state and worried that I would get sick to my stomach and throw up, she determined that I was bulimic and had body issues. And when I tried to tell her I wasn't worried about being fat, she said, oh, well, that's denial. That's the most common feature of bulimia. And she suggested, I'll always remember this, she said that she was like, stomach acid regurgitated will strip the enamel from your teeth. So you should save those pearly whites for the pearly gates.
That is funny because I was bulimic in college till I found that out. And then, that fucks up your teeth. And then I stopped being bulimic. So it actually worked for me, but it wasn't.
That would have been good advice for me if that's what I was suffering from. But it was like she was going from this textbook.
Because they'll take anything. They're just looking for something to answer what you need.
Right.
I love your voice so much. It's really engaging and easy to listen to. And I want to remind the story where the audience that they can get Maggie Rowe's book, Sin Bravely, A Memoir of Spiritual Disobedience. It's available on Audible. And listeners can get her audiobook free with a 30-day trial membership by going to audible.com/storyworthy. Again, that's audible.com/storyworthy. And it really... The voice, your voice must really helped when you were doing all of those scripture memorization competitions.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I used to compete in these Bible verse memorization
contests. Tell us about that.
Basically, what they would do is they would read a passage. We would have buzzers. So they would read a passage and you would be, you know, competing with other kids from other churches, and you would slam the buzzer if you knew the answer. So
wait, there's a game show host.
There's a host. So he would say, you know, the most classic one, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son, that whoever believes in him will not perish. And then when you knew it, you would slap it down and go, John 3:16.
It's just unbelievable. And so was there like a studio audience?
Yes. So there would be, and they would cheer.
Would they say, praise you, or you know, they wouldn't say good luck. They'd say, Lord be with you.
Yes, yes, yes. May the Spirit be with you.
May the Spirit. Yeah. Holy Spirit, fair play.
And then we'd get, you know, we got these trophies. So I amassed, you know, this whole slew of trophies. The biggest one was a gold statue of a little girl with pigtails holding a Bible aloft.
It just makes my heart break. That is so unbelievable.
And I would look at those trophies and feel like, okay, well, maybe that means I'm on fire for the Lord. You know, would a non-Christian have all these trophies, especially a gold one with a girl with pigtails holding a Bible aloft? You know, like anything that would confirm for me that I had, in fact, been saved was of some sort of comfort.
Are your parents alive now?
Yes, my parents are.
And of course, they've read your book. They know what you went through. What do they say about it now?
I was so nervous about them reading it because I was worried that they would feel that it was either an attack on their parenting or an attack on their faith. And I really tried not to make it that because they were wonderful. And anytime I told them that I was scared, they tried to be reassuring. But I knew that they had been wrong before. You know, like my mom, you know, would tell me there's roast beef in the fridge and she had, dad had eaten it. So she was wrong. Like I'd clearly seen her be wrong about small things. So it was like, they could be wrong about this. They could tell me that I'm saved and they could be incorrect. I knew that they were fallible human beings, so I just couldn't trust them. But I finally gave my parents the book and I was so nervous. And when I finally talked to them, you know, I was like, well, what did you think? And my mom said, I'm just so sorry you had to go through this, kid. And then they paused and my dad was like, but we're so proud of you.
Wow.
Like, and it really, wow. They're wonderful Christians. And I actually think that if they had been hypocrites, if they had not been good people, my break from Christianity would have been far easier. But the fact that I had wonderful examples of the Christian faith made it more difficult.
But they put you in the path of these people who were not safe. I mean, even recommending that you go to that evangelical What is it called? Even recommending that you go there to the psychiatric institute. I mean, at that point, maybe they could have said, Maggie, you don't need that. You need a regular psychotherapist or something. You know what I mean?
They still believed these ideas. And actually, this place did end up helping me. I had this one wonderful therapist.
Dr. Benton.
And
I read your book.
He was the one who told me this idea of sin bravely. And it comes from a Martin Luther quote, which is, sin bravely in order to know the forgiveness of God. And his idea was, it is far more important that you feel safe, that you feel forgiven, that you feel the love of a loving God, than that you follow the letter of the law or legalism. And he was just like, go out, do whatever you want.
Do you think he read your book?
I've tried desperately to find him through Facebook, through all of the, but I haven't been able to.
I had a therapist in my 20s that my first husband got another girl pregnant while we were married. Yeah, that didn't work out because I'm flexible, but not quite that flexible. But I've tried to look for him because, yeah, that man made such an impact in my life as my therapist at that time. And, you know, and he's the one that said, you know, maybe Christina was actually, you know, the fact that your dad left and like kind of was able to pull me, you know, explain it to me and break it down.
Yeah. Like if you get a good therapist, it really can be life changing. And if I went to a secular hospital, it wouldn't have helped me because I was still within the system. Needed help within.
I'm so glad you didn't get involved in Scientology because it sounds like that you could maybe, you know, that could have grabbed you too. Could have grabbed you.
Totally. I had those OCD tendencies. So tons of other kids went to this church and went to the Bible camps that I went to, and it didn't affect them the way that it did me.
Do you ever think like, I wish my parents had pushed me into piano or tennis?
You know, it's
maybe
funny,
that would have latched on, you know?
It's so funny that you say that because those are the two things they did kind of push me towards.
Really?
Yes, piano lessons, and they were big tennis players.
Do you play?
Yeah, a little.
Oh, right on.
But, you know, I didn't have a talent for piano or for tennis.
But you could memorize scripture.
But I could memorize scripture. So they never pushed me into that. It was totally me. I felt that if I became, you know, the more I witnessed to people, like we used to go to shopping malls.
I know, I have that written down right here. What would you do at the shopping malls?
So at shopping malls, you know, the whole youth group would go and
they'd take you in a bus or a van.
Yep.
They'd drop you off at the Orange Julius.
Yes.
They say, good luck.
Good luck. They would let us loose and we would just go up to different people and, you know, we always would have an opening line, you know, something like, did you know you have a best friend? And they would be like, what? And I'd be like, his name is Jesus. I'd love to tell you about him. And, you know,
wow.
90% of the time, they, you know, I was a kid, so people wouldn't be rude so much.
They would talk with you. They would engage you.
Sometimes they would. So about 10%, you know, would want to talk more about it. And, you know, they were also like, you know, the creepy, I mentioned in the passage, but the creepy guys outside of Spencer Gifts, you know, who would always be like, oh, yeah? All right. Yeah. Tell me about it. You
come
know,
under the black light. Let me show you under this big plastic, you know, penis.
And I might have some more questions. So if you gave me your phone number, maybe, you know.
Yeah. Shopping malls were like so the place to hang out because you grew up outside of Chicago.
Yep.
And I was outside of Pittsburgh, sort of similar, Midwest.
Yep.
And we don't have a lot more time, but I wanted to ask you, how do you know at the end of 3 months that you are okay? Or how do you, what's the...
So I still wasn't okay. But with the help of Dr. Benton and with medication, I needed to be on medication. And that was kind of progressive of them because a lot of, you know, Christian counselors would say, you know, you don't need medicine, you need the Holy Spirit. But they were at least evolved enough to know, we got to get this girl on some drugs.
Yeah.
So by the time I left, I was suffering less from anxiety, but it would be years before it completely subsided.
Did that boyfriend, did he split on you?
We stayed together. We dated for 4 years. Now he lives in Los Angeles and he's one of my closest friends.
Oh my gosh.
So
Do you use his real name in the book?
No, no, I changed his name.
I'm just curious.
Yeah. His name is Chris.
Yeah.
Chris DeJuan.
Yeah. Chris, wait, is that, that's his name?
Yeah.
Oh, that is his name. Okay, yeah, great. Yeah, yeah. Okay, now we know.
He was wonderful to me. And when we got back together, you know, I still said that we couldn't have sex because that was still
you
a
held
sin.
To your guns.
I held
until
to my
what?
Guns. Until probably maybe a year and a half.
Oh my gosh.
Later.
Thanks, Kurosawa.
Yeah, thanks, Kurosawa.
And then you did have sex with him again, the boyfriend.
Yeah.
Well, so he held on. So
yeah, he was
well,
a good,
good
guy.
For him.
He was
I
a good
guess
guy.
So. Listen, are you religious at all now?
Now I regularly attend a Zen center. I was just there this morning for their garden meditation. But meditation has helped me a great deal with anxiety and the kind of looping obsessive thoughts that I have even without the hell stuff.
Right. But meditation gives you exercises, counting, breathing exercises that get you in touch, which can fulfill you the same way religion can with things that are the call and response and the rote, because
totally.
It's essentially the same thing. It's a meditation, which by the way is tennis. It's just meditation. Hit
the ball,
and
back
concentrate
and
just think about that at that moment. You can't play the game of tennis and not be in the moment.
That's right. That's right.
So these are all sort of, these are all good things to do. Without the need of religion.
Right, right. Just watching my breath, watching the thoughts go through, you know, like identifying with your observer
See that?
Self.
Wonderful. This is a great story and a wonderful book, really. Congratulations on it. All right, you guys, I got to wrap it up right now. I want to thank you all so much for tuning in today. Here's what you need to do. You should tweet Maggie and let her know that you enjoyed her story at Sit and Spin LA. And then you can follow me over there as well at Storyworthy. It always comes back to me, Maggie. I can't help it. What can I say? You guys also feel free to email me anytime at info@storyworthypodcast.com. I return all emails. And join us next week on Storyworthy for Hollywood manager Barry Katz and his story, I Killed JFK.
The majority of the population has been told that Lee Harvey Oswald killed Kennedy. There isn't one person that was a witness that saw Oswald in the window.
Don't miss this incredible story by Barry Katz next week on Storyworthy. All right, I want to thank everybody over at Wondery Media, including Hernan Lopez and Jeffrey Glazer. And one more time, on behalf of Maggie Rowe, thank you so much, friend. Thank you.
So with you.
My name is Christine Blackburn, saying, make it a story-worthy week.
Thanks for joining us on the Storyworthy Podcast. We'll be back next week with all new stories. Subscribe to Storyworthy on iTunes and visit the Storyworthy website at storyworthypodcast.com.